The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome back, everyone, to Vox Markets. My name is Paul Hill. I'm delighted again on Exchange Live to speak to accomplished stock picker Richard Crowe, alias Cockney Rebel. So welcome, Richard.
Paul.
Yeah, well,
nice sunny morning at last. So, well, got a few of these moments. That's good.
It is near. The weather's supposed to be great tomorrow, but we've had a ton of volatility of late, not least last Monday, sort of mini meltdown over in Japan, and also hit the sort of the tech stocks as well on the back of fears of a US recession and the unwinding of the yen carry trade. But before we sort of run through your view of the markets, I don't suppose you could just quickly remind the audience what kind of stocks you like, what kind of investor you are.
Well, I like small cap stocks mainly. I go to mid caps as well. I like recovery plays, basically. They're the stocks I really like, but I don't really go much for new floats. I like to be able to see a track history in a stock, go back and look at, see what it's done in the past, and ask myself, can it redo that in the future? And I think probably that's what I've done for the last 15 years now. I've been into recovery plays as much as I can. So I'm looking for stocks that are bombed out, severely bombed out, and people don't, you know, people have got no interest in, or they're absolutely fed up and tired of the company. And that's the point at which I think they're most interesting, when nobody's talking about them on the internet and everyone's written them off. Often that's when the price of the share is completely, you know, misaligned with the market, and it's far too cheap in a lot of cases. So that's the type of thing I go for. And I do a little bit of trading on the meanwhile when I get bored. There'll be an odd stock that comes out a bit of news. I'll shove a few quid in it and then hopefully make a few quid. I'll probably manage to make about 50-50 on those. But it's always boredom trades. Yeah. Things when I'm sat there, nothing's happening. I think I'll have a little dabble and half come good, half don't. I think I won't keep doing it if I didn't make a bit of money, but I don't enjoy trading that much. I buy something good and just stick them away and sleep easy at night and cut out the stress of washing stuff as much as I can.
Yeah, no, I must admit, I'm not a great trader myself. But when it comes to sort of identifying those turnaround plays, that's a sort of the, you know, the thesis being you invest when there's blood on the streets, but the hit rate tends to be less on there. How do you go from a fundamentals basis sort of identifying these, which turnarounds you're going to put your money into? I understand that the bowl with the share price sort of before, yeah, chart we've done, but just on the fundamentals, how do you pick between a sort of value play and a value trap?
I think you've got to look back. First of all, I want to make sure there's no dilution there, you know, sort of very little dilution from something of a company that's done fantastically well in the past, and there's no dilution. I think I slipped up once on SHI, the company, SIG, the materials, building materials company. And I thought that was going to be a great, you know, amount of times I watched it and thought, well, this is recovery and it's not. And they got a guy in there and I thought this was probably it. And I totally missed up on the dilution that was there. And so ever since that point, I've watched dilution very closely. So that's one of the main things. But it's going to be a company that's done really well. It's bombed out. Possibly 90% off his eye would be great, you know, and sort of like, and they've got a new board in there. So once they get a new board in there, I don't want to touch them until they've got a new board. Mm. I've said it many times, you know, a bad director doesn't turn into a good director, very rarely anyway. And so if a board hasn't been very good, then likelihood is that they're not going to suddenly change. They're not, you know, they're not going to go to a seminar, suddenly realize what they're supposed to be doing and do everything right. So we'll see the old board kicked out, new board come in, and I'm still not expecting anything from a company then until, you know, at least 6 months. It's going to take 6 months to a year before you see tangible progress from a company normally. Mm-hmm. And so they're the sort of things I look for. And once I see that, I'd like to see a company just, they ain't got to sound positive, they've got to sound a little bit less negative. So they get that point where they sound less negative, and perhaps really good would be to see a bit of director buying as well. And when you get that combination of all those things, and I start to see the chart just starting to curve up, that's what you want to see, a nice curve on that chart at the bottom as well. It hasn't got to have that. Sometimes you get a bounce from a spike. Rolls Royce, for instance, you know, that's one where you've got a new board in there. and sort of that was bombed out. And when you look back now at what it was valued at, and a new ball comes in, and it didn't even need like a curve up. That was just Tufan got in there and said, "That's it." You know, like this is a burning platform. Yeah, and at that point, when he said that, you should have scared out every investor you can possibly think of. Those words, burning platform, should have got all the weak money out. And that was the time to buy it. Unfortunately, I wasn't paying attention enough when he said that. And I still thought there was a lot more to go. Not a lot more, but there was more to go. And I didn't pick them up to about £1.40. And they were at 70. I could have got them at 70 pence. So a bit miffed that I didn't get in down there in the double digits. But £1.40 is not bad over the time that I've had out of those.
You're a hard man to please there, Richard. I actually remember that moment, the burning platform on Rolls-Royce, and I had the same view, and I thought he was going to totally kitchen sink the first result. Yeah. And he ended up didn't doing that at all. He basically reiterated guidance, didn't he?
So the other board, and there have been a lot of director buying going on there. You know, the clue there was all that director buying continuously. And I'd ignored it. You know, there's that much director buying, I was ignoring it because I just thought, you know, why is it just still going in? But, you know, shows just goes to show how much investors don't understand a business until you get a decent director in there and they spell it out and suddenly you think, oh, yeah. And so, you know, and like balance sheets as well. I'm not overly concerned with balance sheets in these recovery plays. You know, it's nice to see a bit of asset there and everything else. But in all honesty, the reason these stocks are on their knees is probably because the balance sheet doesn't look that great, you know, and the price of the shares and everything else, nothing looks good. And if you wait for everything to, you know, so you can see it all on the paper, you know, and they come out with a set of results, says, you know, our assets are now this and our debt's down, and you've missed so much of it. So you've got to take a position. You've got to say to yourself, you know, I know there's a risk, but it's not my only stock. You know, I've got 10 or 15 of these. One of these is probably going to go bad. Maybe two or three might go bad. But as long as across the spread, you're picking up lots of similar stocks with the same pattern that's got that same formula. You know, I don't dabble in oils. I don't dabble in farmers. It's got to be these companies that have had a past, they've done well. You know that they've got the potential to get back to where they were, and there's no dilution, so they could get back there quite quickly. And, you know, that's what I look for. And hopefully I find a lot more of them than I find duffers.
Yeah. So, no. Yeah. Have you ever thought about working for CVC or Blackstone? Because that's exactly the strategy of the private equity world. Basically, look for businesses that have got good turnaround potential. And you're effectively capped on your downside because you can only lose as much as your initial stake. But actually, when it comes to sort of your upside, it's unlimited. You can do three, four, five bags. So you're in the wrong profession there, Richard.
No, they can't afford me.
Well, let's move on to that, because your performance, I know we've spoken a couple of times this year, and it's got progressively better and better. Can you update investors on where your portfolio currently lies, and also what you've been doing of late? Because I know the mini meltdown has sort of changed your view of the big macro stuff.
So I spoke, like I remember saying on earlier, from the low in October to Christmas, I was up about 36% to the end of the year. And then from the start of the year to about now, it's about 32%. And so I'm up nearly 90% from the low in October. I need to do about another 10% now, because obviously if you're up, you know, like from October to December, if you're up 36% there and your pot's bigger by the time you're up, and 30% from the start of the year this year. So the total of that works out to nearly 90%. And I was saying to myself, God, I could do double my money in a year here between October and October. And that looked like the plan. And then things have changed in the market. You know, there's so many things that I'm seeing things I don't like seeing. And sometimes you've got to say to yourself, is it worth risking everything in the market to try and make another percent, 10%, and try and hit my target that was there? Or the sensibility say to you, you know, cover what you've got. You know, you've had a good time. That sort of amount, most people kill for that sort of return in a year, you know, and I don't often get a return like that in a year. And I think to myself, do you know what, I'll be quite happy just here with the things that are going on at the moment, just to sit the market out for a few months, two or three months, and see whether I'm right or I'm wrong. And in the past when I've done that, you know, sometimes I've been right, sometimes I've been wrong. But the times that really annoyed me is when I've been right and I didn't do anything. Yeah. You know, sort of you sit there and you watch something, and I suppose best example of that probably be about 3 years ago now when I saw Rolling Top in the market, and I should have probably sold them, but it was so close after COVID and everything else that I ignored it, and I sat in the market with far too much money from that point. And so I ignored a point there where I sell, but one that come good was COVID, you know, got to the end of 2019 and I couldn't find anything that was cheap in the market. There was no low PEs or anything. And I was scratching around thinking to myself, where are these big one, you know, one baggers, you know, potential one baggers, just couldn't see any. And I started hearing about COVID coming along and I thought, do you know what? This market is so complacent. You know, the values are high, the markets are high. COVID comes along, I read about it. And I remember living through foot and mouth, swine flu, bird flu, SARS, all these things that made the market tremble at the time, and the market just wasn't budging. So I thought to myself, do you know what? This is the time to take a lot of cash off the table. And once I started reading about COVID out in China, I just thought, well, the market really is complacent. And I sold out right at the beginning of 2020. Yeah, it was right at the start. And COVID was starting to pick up. The market came off a little bit. And I thought, yeah, I've done the right thing. Then the market went back up a little bit, got back to where it was again. I thought, well, maybe I've jumped out too soon. Like you start to feel these things. And then suddenly, you know, COVID got moving about a bit. And then once it got to Italy, it was just like, wow, you know, sort of. And I was just sat there on the sidelines. I think I sold about 3 or 4% off the high of the market, and just sat there watching shares just plummet in value. I think to myself, lovely, you know, rub your hands together and wait for this to hit the bottom and we'll all be back in again at some point. So that was a good one. You know, other times I've got it wrong, but there's nothing worse than sort of seeing something and not doing something about it and then kicking yourself afterwards thinking, why didn't I? So it's just a defensive position for me. It's probably different for other people. If they're not, you know, made bundles this year, they might want to risk that, but I don't want to give back. It was a lot of hard work making that money, and it's, you know, you don't want to give it back. Yeah, I don't want to give it back.
Well, I must admit that sort of quarter one 2020 in COVID brings back post-traumatic stress disorder for me, no doubt about it, because I mean, I lost a big seven-figure number on that one just in a month. So it was a major collapse.
Yeah. I was sat there watching it and thinking to myself, at what point would I have sold? You know, a lot of people say they're long-term investors and we're going to hold and we're there. But invariably, those people that are long-term investors are the ones that sell right at the bottom because they've got the strongest gut and they've held on for that 40% drop. And finally, that's the point where they say to themselves, I can't take no more. I don't know how low this is going. You know, I've watched my earnings. And it's the long-term investors that sell right. All the jumpy guys have all got out way before. It's the long-term investors that are committed to try and to stay and just finally find they just can't. And that's when the market bottoms, because you've scared out the people who are the hardest. Some people still stayed in there, obviously, but, you know, the bulk of those, and it's those things you've got to say to yourself, if you're going to be a long-term investor, you've got to say to yourself, you know, that's what I believe in, long-term investing. But what is my gut going to be like if there's a massive fall like that? And am I going to be the sort of person who sells at the bottom? And, you know, that's what you've got to know, your own gut. I don't have that sort of gut, you know, sort of when the market starts coming off a lot. I like to sleep at night. Sleep's at a premium around here.
No, sleep's for wimps, mate.
Yeah. You know, I get kept to about 11:30 and I'm awake again at 2:00. And then if I start thinking about anything, I'm awake for the rest of the night then. So when the market's like that, you know, I'm sat down and I'm thinking, well, you know, I don't want to lose sleep like this. It's good to be, you know, it's good for your health to be able to go to sleep at night. Yeah. So you shouldn't be invested that much that you're not going to lose sleep. And I've always been sort of nearly 100% invested through the market all the time.
Yeah. And
The 87 crash, I was 100% invested in the 87 crash. And overnight, I lost 27%. And I sold right at the bottom of the market as well. And I watched the market bounce 12% the next day. And so that point was a fantastic learning lesson. You know, make a mistake like that, but learn from it. Yeah. So that's what I've done, you know.
Yeah, no, I remember the 87 crash. I lost my terms student grant, basically, when I was at Southampton, unfortunately, during that. But I mean, I'm a long-term investor, and I've been through the, you know, the dot-com collapse, the LTMs, LTCMA, basically the Asian crisis back in the 90s, which wasn't too bad. Then the great financial crisis. And then obviously, you know, there's a bit of Brexit and a bit of COVID. And what I find is that actually your risk tolerance or your pain tolerance gets bigger and bigger. And you only really know it until you actually blow through it, but you get stronger so you can live through tougher circumstances. And I'm hopefully I won't go through a sort of like a pandemic again. But in terms of your portfolios, how much cash do you currently hold then? Because you were, well, I think we last spoke, just about 100% invested.
Yeah. I'm 80% cash now. So right. I've just got 20% invested. And I can buy back in. You know, if I discover I'm wrong, there's nothing stopping me buying back in. If I give away, 5, 6, 10% in that journey, it's not the end of the world to me. But there's so much risk about at the moment that people are ignoring that I just don't understand how the market is so calm. I watch the fear greed index and the VIX and stuff like that, and watch, at the moment, 25 is the fear greed sat at. So it's not extreme fear, but it's fear.
Yeah,
but the amount of things we've got going on at the moment. You got out in the US. What did you say to me? 5 rate cuts priced in at the moment. Did you say the other?
Yeah, it's about five in the next 12 months. Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
So I look at the inflation numbers yesterday. I'm thinking, are those 5 rate cuts because things are happy and they're going to see inflation go down and they're going to cut rates and everything's great, or are those 5 rate cuts being priced in because the market's slowing and the Fed's going to have to cut rates 5% to keep the market turning over? So there's that bit there with the US that I'm not completely sure with. There's, Japan and the carry trade going on over there, and everyone wasn't aware of that. But, pure luck, I sold on the Friday, the day before the carry trade plunge happened, and I sold out 75% of the money. I didn't see that coming, but I was sort of watching some things about here and there that I didn't like, and that was the point at which was it. So money when I woke up in Japan was down that much. I was as gobsmacked as anybody, but when I looked then, if they're going to raise rates again, I was told they wanted to do two more hikes, didn't they, or something, Japan? Did I read? Yeah. I read, so they did two more. That carry trade gets hit a bit more, and it was like a distrust on steroids, really, wasn't it? That's a bit, all these leveraged debt obligations all suddenly have got to be funded from somewhere. And so these funds sell anything. So equities are nice and liquid, they go. And if Japan does that again, I suppose that all those invested in the carry trade are going to do so. So there's that on that side of things. And then we've got Middle East. A lot of these countries surrounding Israel, sort of like they're going to get together and kick off there. And it's just, the talks at the moment, I've never known any country in the Middle East, when they have these fights, I've never known anyone back down. Mm-hmm. It usually backs down after some big, battle goes on, and in the end, it all, the US gets involved and stuff like that. So this Iran saying they were going to retaliate on Israel, if they don't retaliate, they sort of feel that they've lost face, and there's a battle going on there to try and keep people happy together and, try and calm all this lockdown. So there's that tension there. Then we've got the UK, we've had a new government for a month, and it's just, the whole country seems to be falling apart with riots and, there's this budget that she's come out with that's got a 20 billion black hole. So I'm sitting there thinking, how are they going to fund that then? So it's going to be tax rises or cuts of some sort. There's not a lot of things they can cut. They said they're not going to tax Joe Public here, there and everywhere. So I'm wondering, is it corporation tax is going to get upped again, or what are they going to do to raise this money? So until a budget's out of the way, I just like to sit there and see what Magic Rachel does.
Yeah. Well, autumn is certainly a traditionally a pretty volatile period. Yeah. But I would also say that with the yen carry trade, what happened sort of 10 days ago, that is a bit of a flush out of the system. So that is probably a healthy side, reducing gearing, going forward. And the market overall does climb a wall of worry, doesn't it? There's a lot of cash on the side. So how are you holding your cash, by the way? Is it in bonds, or is it basically just straight in your brokerage account? You're getting like 3% or so?
Yeah, I haven't got the bonds because I'll be capable of losing as much money as I'd make in bonds if I wanted to get back into equities. So I think I'd just leave it on deposit in my fund and wait until I feel like I've got to or get back into the market. So, yeah, I like it to be very liquid and easy to deal and, you know where I am with it. So,
good.
Yeah. And I always keep a cash pile anyway, just to time me for a couple of years if there was a bad time. I was caught up in amongst bad times. But, yeah, so, that, you know, that's that all that fear that's in there, I just feel it'd be wise just to sit this out for a couple of months. And if I lose a few bob, okay, but, you know, I've guarded what I've got and I can come back and I know I can make money in, I can make money in the market. So we'll see where we go.
Okay, good. If anybody wants to ask Richard any questions, please put them into the chat bot and I'll read them out. We've had one before from Ariel Conan. He basically asks about Card Factory, which I know when we first chatted, probably around about 6-9 months ago, was your largest position. You had about 30% in there. What's your, sort of your latest on this one? It basically does celebration cards from retail outlets around the UK. History that it had a bit of a weak balance sheet, but generated. But that seems to now be not a problem. Clinton Cards, one of its rivals, was subsequently has obviously gone bust as well. And Moonpig, the online guys, seem to be doing okay. So cards seem to be back. What's your view?
It's great company, great, fantastic cash flow, because it has such fantastic cash flow. And they had piles of debt, and that Darcy Wilson-Reimer came into the business, and I really rate him as a CEO. I listened to everything he said. There was no bull there. It was all good stuff. And so, you know, I invested in that. I think I went in at about, where did I go? About 45, 50p, somewhere, a little bit less than that, 45 pence. I think averaged in at about 45 pence. I was buying a lot lower than that, and I was buying a lot higher than that, but my average was about 45, and I think at 90, I'd pretty much double my money in those. And but there's a problem there with Telios. It was a fund that were constantly dumping shares, you know, and they've got 20%, and they bought at the highs, and they were selling at the lows. It was just bizarre. So as fast as you could try and make money in there, they were just killing it all the time. You can see all those highs on that chart, across your chart. Now, they were the point, every time it got to like £1.10, £1.15, you know, the market just came off again. So at that point, it looked like it was dead money to me until Telios got out. And as it happens, Telios got out a month or two ago, and now the chart's managed to carry on up. And I did buy some back, but I sold those when I sold everything up, you know, a couple of weeks ago. But still like the company. Yeah. I think it's great little company, but like I say, you can't pick and choose. I've kept a few stocks that I think have really got the potential to go a lot higher, but I've only kept a few, you know, basically I haven't trimmed everything across the top. I've kept the few that I think can really outperform. So,
yeah.
But if the market turns around, I'll go back into Car Factory at some point, probably. So I think it's got a long-term stock. Great management. Clinton's haven't gone bust. There's only a part, they keep shutting stores, and they're owned by American Greetings out in America, and that's a family-owned business. And, you know, so because Clinton's haven't got the margins, they don't print their own cards. So they're fighting a losing battle against them and Moonpig. Yeah. I can't see Clinton's lasting, to be honest. Yeah. But, you know, they're gradually dripping their way out of the high street and stores disappearing, so. Car Factory has got, you know, 1,200 stores across the country. Fantastic.
Yeah, well, I mean, it pays a 3.5% dividend now, and also is only trading at 9x PE, so it isn't exactly priced to perfection. There's still plenty of upside. Okay, we've got a question from Terry Vaughan. He's basically saying that during the Japanese trade chaos, I did not sell. Is that a good strategy? And I suppose that he should just listen to what you said earlier on, I guess. It's sort of like you've got to make your own view, haven't you, really?
Yeah, you know, sort of, I didn't sell because of the Japanese. You know, I sold before that, you know, literally just right before it, because of other things that I didn't like that was going on. So, but I think if you set for it and you're confident and, you know, best thing to do is always stick to what works for you.
Yeah,
you know, if something works for you and it's worked and worked and worked, don't change anything. You know, people say to me, "Oh, Cockney, have you ever thought about going into Forex and doing Forex?" I sort of think, you know, I'm a small fish in a big pond as it is. You know, I don't need to be a blooming sprat in an ocean in Forex and stuff like that, or oils. I don't understand oil stocks, and I don't understand pharmaceuticals, and I'm not great at a couple of bits of tech, but invest in what you know. And if you invest in what you know and you feel confident and everything else, And that with the market as well. You're happy with the market. You can say, just keep doing it if it works.
Yeah.
You know, I don't want to say ways to skin a cat, really. You know, it's several, you know, we all like loving different sizes. What was it, the House Martins or the Beautiful South? And so we all do things different ways. And if it works for you, then that's great. You know, so I know what works for me. And I think if mate's kept his money in through the Japan thing, he'll do well probably.
Yeah.
If he's worked for him before.
Yeah. And also I would say, you know, have a look at what you own in terms of the actual stocks, because some stocks may be impacted by a yen carry trade. I mean, if you own, I don't know, investment trusts out in Japan, then they probably haven't done so well just of late, but they've bounced back. And actually, if you've bought sort of Japanese stocks, at least the currency's worked in your favor, no doubt about it, because that's sort of strengthened. But have a look at what you own. And if basically the stocks you own aren't going to be impacted at all by the yen carry trade, then don't get worried. Now, that brings us neatly onto one stock I believe you still own, which you still like, is CMC Markets. Because if anything, this is a company that obviously is a spread better CFD, but is building a fintech sort of like a financial platform that other businesses are running on top of, like Revolut, etc. What's your sort of your latest on here? But because it should have, if nothing else, done reasonably well out of the market volatility last week.
That's the one I've kept the most of. You know, that was my biggest holding. It was 30% of my portfolio, and so I was up total holdings. I was up, I think, 50, somewhere like 50-55% on those. So, you know, I've been buying all the way up as well. So some are too bagged, some I bought further up. So I sold half of those. So I now hold half of what I had.
Mm.
But it's my favourite stock at the moment. It's run by Peter Kratos, Lord Peter Kratos, who's absolute excellent investor. He's just never sold any shares since it floated. And he's there. He's as keen as the day he was 21, I think, to keep the business going. And, you know, he's active. And what they're actually doing is white labeling lots of their products, the sort of stuff that they've been doing for ordinary private investors. And now they're doing it scaled up to businesses. And, you know, they're also providing sips and ices now for investors that they never did before. And I think they made 18 pence, was it, this year? But, I think the earnings was about 16p. But they lost money in the first half. So in the second half, I think they made about 18 pence in earnings.
Yeah.
I'm sat there thinking, I still don't understand how they can't do way over what the current forecasts are of about 22-23p earnings if they made that much in the second half. And this year they've got 21 million in cost savings that are going to come through, so that should increase their margins as well. So the forecast just look way too light to me, that, you know, for them not to potentially bust those to pieces. So that's why I've hung on to them as my main holding that I'm most confident with. So and it's a cracking stock. I mean, I look at it compared to IG Index, and now that's sort of performed over the time. And, you know, this just seems to be well run. They've got bundles of cash above. I think it's about 180 million in cash. And some of that will probably be, I'm sure it's deposits and stuff that they can't get their mitts on. But it's, you know, and they're going to pay 50% of earnings out in dividend. So I just had a nice 7.5p dividend, 7.3p dividend from them for this year. And, you know, if they did 18 pence in the second half, you can see there's the capability. They've got huge operational gearing. You see there's the capability of sort of like doing 25 pence or more in a half. And I just think, well, if there's that capability there, suppose they did 50 pence earnings. Yeah, they were doing that in COVID. They were doing 60 pence, I think it was, during COVID.
Yeah.
Suppose they get back to doing that and they're going to pay 30 pence in dividend. You know, that's a 10% yield plus from where they're, you know, got roughly a 10% yield from where they are here if they did that. So that's the potential. So you've got to ask yourself, what's the potential in a stock? How much risk are you going to take on it? And what's the downside? And it just looks like there's a lot of potential upside with, you know, pretty low downside, really. And that's what you're trying to do all the time, isn't it? But, you know, reduce the risk to as low as you can, but find something that's got huge upside as well. So for me, that's the one that stands out in the market, I think, at the moment.
Yeah, so, no, I would agree. I've actually, just give you an anecdotal sort of, you know, data, et cetera. I've actually spoken to the management team on this one, and they think, and they're guiding towards, you know, improving margins going forward, largely on the back as they roll out this fintech platform to other providers like Revolut and to other ones who want their best in class sort of SIPs and ISAs and all that, you know, dealing platform, etc. And that's just pure profit. So I'm with you. I actually think the management team are really confident about delivering better financials going forward. And even on those reduced numbers, they're still not trading at particularly, you know, high levels, 15 times P or 15 and a half times P and 2.5% dividend yield. And, you know, yeah, on those numbers, they're not expensive. Not for a fintech company that is basically... Yeah.
They're not valued like a fintech. They're not valued like a fintech. And really, that's what they are, you know. So it's...
good spot.
Yeah,
good spot. Now, we've had another question from Nigel Batty Seams and also from Jazz asking about Avon, which is Avon Technologies now. It used to be Avon Protection. They basically do body armor and defense protection helmets and stuff like that. Well. Yeah, and also breathers and stuff. What's your latest on this one? Because again, the shares have performed brilliantly. It was a fantastic turnaround play that you identified.
Yeah, I was in just off the bottom there. About £7 I went in, and I more or less doubled my money from there to back in May. Again, that's one I've sold. I still like them, but I had reduced on those because there was things that I could see that looked like it could grow faster. But Josh Slater there and the aptly named Rich Cashin as the CFO,
yeah,
it's just you know, they've done a good job. You know, they've been here before in two other companies where they've been here and they've ended up in a takeover bid. And I suspect these will probably get taken over at some point because they're a small British defence company rattling around among the Nord Streams or whatever, not Nord Streams, but the Norfolk Grumman and all that type of business, the big defence companies that are out there in the US, and they'd be peanuts to take out. And they're probably the biggest helmet makers for defence. And they've got the... these rebreathers as well, and the other thing they do are the oxygen masks, the breathing masks.
Yeah,
and that's not such great margin, really. That, you know, that's part of the business. The other two rebreathers that allow people to go underwater for ages without having to, you know, have oxygen. It regenerates its own oxygen, so they're starting to pick up in sales as well. So I think that's a good company, and the guys running it seem to know what they're doing. They've been at two. You know, GKN was one of them, and Ultra Electronics was the other, and they both ended up getting in takeovers. So I see, but you know, having double money, you know, I often like to half what I've made, half my holdings on a double. So that was a bit of advice given to me when I was about 22 years old when I started this. And the guy said to me, you know, sell half on a double. I said, what do you mean? You know, when you double your money, you sell half on a double your money that quick, can you, on these things? Didn't realize shares would double that quick, you know. I was out looking to make 20%, you know, sort of. And so that's what I've done then a lot of the time. Not if it's a real scream, I've held on longer and not halved on the double, but I do like to take a bit on the way up, and so you reduce your average cost across the screen. You can't get back so much as you would have done.
Well, the rest go. If you halve it, basically having double, you get the rest for free, don't you? It's the same, exactly, actually, advice.
Yeah, you're carrying a free carry, they are then, aren't they? So it's like great. You can sit there and just sit back a lot more comfortable then and say, well, you know, they're not going to go to null. I've made a profit there and I'm not going to lose all the profit I've made. So that's nice.
It's exactly the same advice that my dad still gives me, basically, because he's been investing for about 60-odd years, more than 60 years. And he sort of like slices off half whenever he's taken, he made 100% because it just allows him to sleep well at night, like you.
Yeah. Us old codgers are like that. We like our sleep.
You're a spring chicken still, Richard.
Yeah.
Okay, let's move to a really live turnaround at the moment, which is quite contrarian, should we say, Capita, which is basically a UK outsourcer that has been a widow maker for the likes of Neil Woodward for years. But it's got peaked of interest of other people, your peer group, like Richard Staveley on and Rockwood Strategic, who's now bought in as well. What's your sort of your latest on this one? Because they sold one of their software businesses for about 200 million quid, cleared out all their debt just recently, which has really helped the balance sheet. But they came out with the results and they're still looking at like for like slight single digit declines and stuff. Yeah. So, and they've got the obviously with the government coming in, it's difficult to know how outsourcers are going to fare with Rachel Reeves and the new Treasury.
Well, I've looked at this time and time again over the years and sort of thought to myself, God, you know, how much they've come down. But they've never looked like they've got any management in there. The thing is, they've got a new CEO in there now, Adolf Hernandez, I think. Adolf Hernandez.
Yeah, he's a rock star, apparently.
Yeah. So, and he's brought in his girl. I think the CFO is one of his previous people as well, from where he last was. And, you know, like he's come in there and said he's going to do something. It all looked a bit, you know, sort of two fan at Rolls Royce. You know, yeah. So he came in and said he was going to do something. So he's sold a big business off, and everyone was sort of quite surprised by how much he got for it, I think. And it, you know, it's one of those, they're dealing with the debt, and you've got to take a position as to say, you know, do I think they can turn this around? You know, and he's delivering a little bit on what he said he was going to do quite early. So I'm always willing to give someone the benefit of the doubt there, I think. And I only actually spotted this because of Richard Staveley. I'm not going to take credit for finding that one. He spotted it.
He watches you as well, Richard.
Yeah.
Two Richards together.
It was interesting because I was watching his interview the other day, and he's exactly the same. He looks at companies that have got a past history. They're not really that interested in new businesses or reasonable float. So they want companies where they can look back. And I think that's really important in trying to find, you've got to have it for recovery place, but it really is good to see a company that you know can get back to where they were. You know, there's the ability to get back to where they were if they do things right. There's a little bit of dilution, I think, in capital. I think it's about 20% or so, but it's not a lot.
When you say dilution, do you mean basically that's in the treasury? Is that basically employee shares or
more options? Shares about where they've had fundraisings and stuff like that.
Oh, so, I see. Right, okay.
You know, so you end up with, you know, instead of if a company had 40 million shares for 20 odd years and suddenly they have a fundraising, you've now got 10 times as many shares. You're never going to get the dilute EPS is never going to get back to where it was, because you dilute, you know, it's 40 times the amount of people are sharing the earnings between them. So it's important to look at those and see how many shares are in issue. So and however they got there, whether it's through directors having share options and they've taken them up, or just been given shares, and or they've had a fundraising and they've raised shares to get the debt down and stuff like that. Each time they do that, you obviously, the earnings are going to, when they make profits, it's going to be diluted up as far as investors go. So investors are going to get less profit per share than they would have done if they weren't dilution. So that's important for seeing shares rebound. You know, and if you want something that's going to absolutely skyrocket and rebound, the future PLCs and stuff of this world that, you know, really take off, you want to see little dilution in there, because that's when they can bounce fast. So,
Yeah, I did notice also the FD's just bought about £206,000 worth of shares, hasn't he? So,
but I think that's probably part of the deal of actually coming to the company. I think that, you know, first day at the company, he's bought shares. You know, was that in his contract to buy shares when he? I don't know whether that's in their contracts or not. So I'm always
it's a big number worried, though, isn't it? It's 1.2 million shares.
Yeah,
it's not chicken feed.
No, it isn't. It's a decent watch, but, you know, so I've noticed a lot of times with these companies, I think that in their contract, these directors can have, it's nice to see them come out later on. I think Darcy Wilson-Ryan at Car Factory, you know, he's got a thing in there where he has to buy so many shares over the course of time. Most of these directors have those clauses built in that they have to, you know, buy so many shares and show this, that, and the other, show a bit of confidence and stuff. And so, but, you know, it's nice that he's buying them straight away rather than waiting a year down the line to buy them when the shares are cheaper. So, yeah, it's nice to see that that's happened. So, yeah, great to see director buying in there. And, You know, that's always a good flag for me. Director buying is very good. You know, wash it up by shares in the company if the directors are not got the nerve to buy shares themselves, you know, and they're looking at the books and seeing what's going on. So I like to see director buying nearly every share that I hold.
Yeah, well, it's got to be encouraging if the CFO does it, because it means that that's been a question over the balance sheet, and now that they've cleared all their debt, then you usually don't find prudent finance directors dip into 200 grand unless the balance sheet is sorted out. That's for sure.
No. Although they do exist out there, there's something exists out there, but I'm sure it's not one. You know, if I went on AIM, I've seen some weird things in my time.
Yeah,
you know, I bought a company where a chairman bought £250,000 worth of shares, and I thought, oh, you know, that's great, fantastic that he's bought those shares. And then within 2 weeks, they were suspended. And I just thought, what? You know, like £250,000. And everyone thought, you know, chairman's bought £250,000. He's not much of a buy. He suddenly bought shares. You almost sit there and think, did he want to ramp the share price up for somebody else and get the share price up so they could get out? And he got that much money, £250,000 didn't mean too much. But I don't know. You know, it was just bizarre. So it does happen out there, but it's rare. Buying's a director buying is a good little flag there to tell you that things are going the right way, possibly.
Yeah, no, you're right. Okay, just a reminder, if anybody wants to ask questions, please put them in the chat. But I've had one from AA31. He's asking about Crichton's. And he's saying, did you sell out completely, Richard, or you still got a position in the business?
This is
just for the investors. This is basically does sort of like detergents and personal products and basically have its own brands, and also contracts for other brands and does supermarket own brands as well.
Yeah, I do contract stuff for other businesses. So they just make stuff for other businesses. They do white labeling for the likes of Tesco's and a few others. So they make the products for Tesco's. And they also do their own brands as well. So that's where the real margin is for them, by selling their own brands. They slipped up by buying Emma Hardy, which is like a makeup company that they paid so far over the top with. And then it just didn't deliver the earnings that they expected. It's funny because it's been such a safe company. Little small company that ticked along nicely, doing greatly. And then suddenly, for some reason, Bernard Johnson, the boss, come on and he was on like PI World or wherever it was. And we're going to acquire this and we're going to do that. And we've got like all these property assets that we could spend if we want. And we've got this cash and we're going to invest it. And he was talking about doing 100 million of sales within probably by now. I think he thought he was going to be doing 100 million of sales. And he bigged it up really big on PI World. And I sort of thought, oh, you know, like it's unlike him, you know, it's just, you know, he really sounds like he's got a bit between his teeth here. But of course, they paid miles over the odds for MRD, and the guy who sold it to him, he's off and gone, just got rid of it now. It's all in their hands. So they started losing, you know, the profits were diving hand over fist. In all honesty, though, they've got this girl there called Pippa Clark, she really is a good CEO. You know, she's come up through the company. I think they got her when they acquired Potter or whatever it was down in Devon. And then she came with that and she's worked her way up to CEO now. And, you know, they've done the right things. They've got all the factory moved across to one factory. They've cut two shifts out. They were doing three shifts. So they're only doing one shift. So it's a lot of labour costs they've chopped out. They've rationalised the factories. They've built a new automated production line out of bits and pieces there from other production lines. So she said that, you know, staff in there are doing that, which has saved them a packet. And they're looking at seeing if they can get another production line out of bits and pieces they've got left. So it's like that. Bernard Johnson and the McElroy, the chairman, that they've both taken a back seat now. And watching the last presentation, they've done pretty well. They've reinstated a dividend at 0.45p. And reinstating the dividends is a big confidence vote for me, you know, to actually do that at this point. And they were questioned about it, and they seem very confident that they can maintain that dividend. And so to me, you know, I actually presented it on, PI World, Sell It to the City. They did three of those. One of the ones I presented was Brighton's, and Bruffy was on there, and he Andy Bruffy come on there and he grilled me on it and that, and you know, it went down from that point after the semi-final one. It went down from that point. He's asked me about it so many times, you know, and we've talked about it. And I sort of thought it was a real letdown, you know, that it peaked. It had potential, but it went and peaked just when I was, you know, telling him about it on PI World, and he seemed quite interested. And there's a lack of institutional write-ups on them or anything, so you can't get a lot of research on them. So, you know, that was sort of almost embarrassing that it did that. But, okay, it's come all the way down to where it is now, and he's just piled in and bought about 10% of the company. So,
has he?
Yeah. So he must have he's been watching them closely as well. So he obviously thought it was a good business. He just had a short-term issue to deal with. So, you know, good on him. And, I've kept me crying because I've brought them down, and I think they're one that could, you know, if they get it right, and it's not the other two old boys that are running it anymore, and this Pepper Clark and the people she's got around her, it could be could be an interesting stock, and no dilution again, like I say, or it'll dilution, I think. But it's
It's got cash on the balance sheet, and I think if CEO can increase the margins, I think they're currently sort of like nearly almost 4%, but they get to historical levels of 7 or 8%, then that will transform the business. One thing though, which is obviously I find it quite difficult, is the market cap's 20 mil, and therefore liquidity's. I don't know how Bruffy managed to get 10%. To be perfectly honest, somebody must have just wanted to drop out a big chunk.
I think McElroy, the chairman, has sold out alone. I think Johnson, the former managing director, I think he's probably in the market to sell a few. So there might be some shares around for a little while for people to pick up a decent stake. So, yeah, I think that's where that's come from. I think he sold up some.
Yeah.
So,
okay. Okay, good. We've got another question coming in. This one's from Dave P. asking your thoughts on Carlclo, which I think you bought recently. This really is an archetypal turnaround. Again, something which has been a perennial disappointment. It basically does sort of precision components that go into aerospace, medicine, and all kinds of industrial applications. I don't think it actually sort of owns the designs itself. I think it's more of a contract sort of manufacturer for precision niche equipment and stuff that goes into long life cycle products, if I remember correctly. But do you want to take us through your latest views on this one? Because it used to be a darling years and years ago. In fact, I think I've got sneak submission about 10 years ago. It used to be about £4 or £5. It almost went bust, but has come bounced back strongly of late.
I watched them go at that £4 or £5, and I always thought, how are they getting to this island? They look so expensive. They got YPAC. They acquired YPAC, right, which was the car headlamps. You know, if you're from the 70s, YPAC was the name of the car spotlights that you bought and stuck on the front of your Ford Escort if you couldn't afford Chevy Oscars. So, and they put the YPAC factory, which ain't far out from me. It's over in Buckingham. So, that was a disaster. You know, they bought that and they ended up making aerials, car aerials and stuff. Completely lost their way of what they do. But what it really are is a precision plastics, mainly. Yes. So they were making the plastics for the COVID. During COVID, they were making the little COVID test plastic thing as well, I think, and various bits. But, yeah, I precision plastics. And they've also got an aerospace division, which makes particular... connectors and stuff like that for aeroplanes and aerospace, and that's starting to do well. But you know, I bought these how long ago? Probably back in around 2020, probably. It was just after COVID, and they've got a new guy in there, Nick Sanders, who was the right hand man to John Moulton at Apex Partners.
Yes, yeah.
So they've been his, and then under a different company, it went with Apex Partners. I forget what the company was now, but he came in and I thought, this is the sort of guy you need. Someone who knows how to, you know, he's got all the stardust rubbed off him from John Moulton at Apex Partners. And just sort of guy, and he talked the talk, you know, he was going to do this, that, and the other. And he brought in two guys, which was Frank Doornbusch as one of the non-execs. And the other guy is, name escapes me now, he's the new CFO. So what's actually happened is Sanders resigned, and the two guys that he brought in as non-executive directors have taken over, and they're running the business. Frank Doornbusch is, I think he's Dutch, and he's got a great history of, you know, he's been with quite a few decent companies where he's had a good history. But Sanders took him on as a consultant as well, and he was being paid, as well as a non-executive director, he was a consultant. And yeah. I sort of got the feeling that this guy was calling the shot. Well, not calling the shots, but Sanders needed him more than Doornbusch needed Sanders for a job. And so when Sanders left, Doornbusch has taken over. And the other non-exec, I can't remember his name at the moment, but anyway, has become finance director. And since they've been in there, they have actually done the changes that, you know, they've been in 2/3 of the business has been completely changed now. And they're just waiting, you know, it's just the third part of the business that they want to really get sharpened up. But he's delivered on the earnings. So far this year, they came in, earnings have started to rise above what they'd forecast. And I think for next year now, for this year, it's about the forecast is for about 2.6p, something like that. And
yeah, that's right.
5.2p next year.
Right.
5.6p next year. I think they're probably going to beat that. And, you know, sort of. So if they do 5.6p earnings next year and they're trading at 30p, it's only a P of 5. And so the real probably hangback is because they've got quite a big pension deficit there.
Yeah.
And that had risen when they put out the last results. But it's a technical factor. And they've got the triennial valuation going on about now. And he says, Doornbusch reckons that the price, the pension deficit will come down a lot. So I forget who the broker was the other day who put out a note on, but they reckon that, picked a number straight out of the air somewhere, saying that if the pension deficit fell 70 million, weird number just to pluck out of the air, 70 million. Mm. But they said that, you know, if it fell 70 million, they think that that would add another 17 pence to their price target, and also potentially mean that they could reduce the payments they're making to the pension. So it would possibly save them another £1 million a year.
Yeah.
So if you get on top of where they're sitting at 5.6p, if they're a little bit ahead of that and you see that 5.6p raise the next year to sort of like 6.5p, then you get the pension bit sorted and that bumps that. You know, I can see sort of the potential for 7 or 8p next year, not this year, but 7 or 8p next year. You know, if you've got P of 3.5, pension deficit coming down, they're dealing with the debt. Debt's coming down, and you've got two guys in there that seem to really know what they're doing this time. So recovery plays, you've got to decide, you know, have you got faith in the board? You know, do they sound like they're doing the right thing? And they sound like it's right for me, and you can't pick too much of the bones apart on it because you don't see all the detail that's there. But one of the things he did say on Investor Meet Company at a presentation about 2 months ago, and he said that Carclo has always promised so much and delivered so little. Mm. And I thought that was a nice statement to hear from a CEO to say that, you know, because having said that, if you go and deliver little now, you look just like part of the thing you criticised, didn't you? So at least he's there and he's owned up. He's said that the company has performed badly in the past and he looks like he wants to, you know, outperform going forward. So I think he sounds a good guy. He looks like he knows what he's doing. And, I'm back the board, you know, back a good board. And they've done well so far since they've taken over from Sanders. So.
Yeah. Well, he's always had lots of potential, no doubt about it. And if he can get onto win some long-term sort of contracts onto, you know, product groups that effectively got long life cycles, then they can improve the margins, get that operating, synergies kicking in, operational sort of like, you know, scale benefits, etc. That'll improve them, you know, improve the profits as well. So,
And they got next to no dilution. I mean, you look at the chart. I think, like you say, they're up at £5. They're £3 now.
Yeah.
I think it's probably 10 or 20% dilution or something. So £4 probably the previous high.
Yeah.
If they get back, you know, if they get back to what they're earning and the pension deficit comes down in line and stuff, that's the potential to get back to the old highs, £4. And there's not the dilution to stop that. It's just a matter of getting the earnings back to where they were. So. Yeah. That's the sort of top thing I'd love to see. Massive, great drop on the chart. No dilution. Chart just started to turn. You've got new board in there.
Yeah.
You're kind of, I've got all those. I cook myself more for selling those than I would actually sell up the whole 80% of my portfolio this week if that comes around. So,
Okay. Well, let's move to another industrial. We came out with an acquisition today, MPAC, which is a sort of high speed packaging factory automation system provider, etc. It usually concentrates on sort of FMCG businesses in food and beverages, but also in healthcare as well. We've got a brilliant blue chip customer list. It made a nice strategic acquisition actually this morning, which bought a vision inspection system to add to their sort of capability of end-to-end solutions, Cigna Vision, I think it was called. What's your sort of your latest on this one? I know they've also got this clean energy business and the batteries with Freya going off as well.
Yeah. Well, like you say, make high-speed production lines.
Yeah.
And they've got a lot of business out in America. The trouble is, it's lumpy. That's the only one thing you say about it. Their business is quite lumpy, so they get some big orders come in, and then they might go for a while. So the last set of results, they were just in line or just under what people were expecting for this book. But one good order and that just changes that, you know. And they do get some big orders. They've got a new CEO in there over the past 18 months, Adam Holland, and I've watched him, and he talks the talk and he walks the walk. You know, he's what he's done in there so far. He's talking about 10%. Sales growth and 10% margin growth there over the coming years. And if he does that, it's a cheap business, really. But they also, they're developing a battery line for Freya, electric car battery line for Freya. And the tests on that have gone well as well. And none of that is priced into their forecasts. So if they have to start building proper big production lines, could be a number of them, there's the potential for huge orders going forward. So I'm sat there and I think it's a great little business. They're based over here in the UK, and it's one of those businesses. He's winning contracts with some big companies now, but I can't say some of these companies don't like him saying who they're working for. So he's had to keep stum on it. But you can see he's itching to name these companies that they've been winning some contracts for. And that little piece that they've bought this morning, I'm sure that's a handy little company. I would imagine they're like tiny little CCTV cameras dotted about in the machinery at strategic positions to see when, a lump of Mr. Kipling's cake drops off the line and it spots that as a potential danger down. Instead of letting it all go too far, it stops. So, like I say, I think it's a great little business. There used to be Molins, which was they started off in life as cigarette machine making company, and they're just dotted out near me as well. So I've kept a watch across them over the course of time, and there's little to no dilution in this one as well, I think. So it's pay a nice dividend going forward, I think, and I think they're concentrating on that as well. So one of those companies is just way too cheap on the PE that it's currently on. So
it's still less than 12. 12 times, isn't it?
You have to be prepared for a bit of lumpiness in the, if they say we're expecting to have 32 million sales in the first half of where it is and it's only 28, you can't go jumping off a cliff and thinking everything's gone wrong because I pick up 10 million sales in the next month or something like that. So that's the way it is. You've got to put up with that lumpiness. The shares are illiquid. So, when everybody jumps out and gets nervous, the shares go down, like probably a buying opportunity when they do go down like that, and take a bit of profit when they spike up when everyone's overexcited. But I think long term, it's a good company, and I'm sure it's going to do well. He came from Rolls Royce, and the new CEO came from Rolls Royce and JCB. Mm. He's got a lot of experience in engineering and everything else, and he seems to be doing all the right stuff. So, again, it's all about management, isn't it? At the end of the day, you've got guys in there that know what they're doing and been around. So,
Yeah, no, I would agree. Yeah, no, I mean, it looks good value, and secular growth trends should benefit from, say, factory automation, smart equipment, and reshoring and all that kind of stuff. So, yeah, they're in the right place at the right time. Got a question coming in from, quick one from Daffodil. He's asking about whether you're still in Reach, which I think is the newspaper group. Was it its own Trinity Mirror or something?
Reach. Reach. I've not been in Reach for about a year odd now. I don't fancy that sector at all, really.
It's newspapers, isn't it?
Yeah, it was Mirror Group, isn't it? And they do
Mirror Group, is it? Yeah.
Yeah, Trinity Mirror it used to be.
Yeah.
Now it's called Reach. And they probably, you know, just recently they look, is that Reach on there? The chart for Reach there?
Yeah, it is, yeah. Yeah. Is it? They've done pretty well recently. Yeah, I mean, I'm not in it.
Yeah, can you do a longer term one on it?
Because it has Yeah. Let's put that up. There it is. That's a longer term one. So that goes back about 3 or 4 years.
Yeah, it's a nice boldy chart. When markets get excited, everyone gets excited over this one because, you know, traders are in there and everything else. So it's quite good when traders going at it. But I don't know. I go on there and there seems to be the website, you know, if they've got a bit of news, you click on it and it's junk news. You know, it's just like, it is just stories that are, you know, it's all picked up for stories and all about advertising and clicks. I don't know. It's generating enough, you know, but down here, I think it could do okay from down here, but I don't think it's going to be one of these, you know, take off again. Like, I'm not sure Future PLC is going to do the same. I saw the other one that's the used to be Johnson Press. It's something World, isn't it?
Yeah, National World.
National World. I saw that one the other day, and the data out from them was pretty good. And it sort of made me think, are these two doing a bit better than I expect? But I don't know. I don't feel like I made a lot of money in Future PLC by buying that when that was sort of smacked out of the bottom. And they were like the equivalent of 10 pence a share, pound a share. I bought in that and sold them when I think like 8 or 9 bagged them and sold a lot of mine at that point, which was a great point then because nobody interested. But now it's got into America. Everybody knows the company. And
yeah,
I think it's one of the same. It's one of those companies people know that it's going to take off a bit when the market starts to take off. And so traders jump in on it. So it's one of those that I'd ride on a trade rather than buy and hold.
Yeah.
You know, because I feel like it's a great investment to have because the product doesn't look that great to me. You know, it's all these clickbait adverts, you know, and you see a story somewhere and you click on it and it goes to their mirror newspaper online sites. And the stories are always very brief. It's just like, you know, Mrs. So-and-so spotted a monkey on Mars or something like that. You know, it's very much Star type. It's not as bad as the
Daily Star. That was brilliant, wasn't it? Adolf Hitler's on the moon.
Yeah, that's it. Priest Diet, my Amsterdam, all that stuff. And you sort of sit there and think, you know what, it's not real news they're giving me there, but they're getting me to try and click on the adverts and stuff like that. And I don't know whether that's still today. It might have worked. Might have been working great a little while back, but I'm not sure everybody clicks on these adverts now, you know.
My sort of like small sort of take on it is such that there's currently the Daily Telegraph being sold, and that is bust basically. It's loss making, has been for years. But there's a trophy asset value to newspapers in terms of politics and influencing social, etc., like that. And you get these, you know, you had basically Jeff Bezos buying the Washington Post, and you've had Warren Buffett also doing it. So people want it because they want it under their banner. And I think that's what you see in the uptick in shares of Reach on the back of somebody hoping that it's basically going to be taken out like the Daily Telegraph. So, yeah, I think you're right. It's a trade rather than a longer-term investment because isn't that so. Yeah. Right, we've got another one from Dave P. asking about Kia. Says it's a solid business, great recovery over the past year. This basically does infrastructure, civil contractor in the UK. Had a bit of a dodgy balance sheet, actually, and a bit of a pension, but shares have responded well and should, in theory, do well if the government does actually meet its promises of new houses and infrastructure and construction, particularly using the PPI type of, you know, outfit for things like the Thames Crossing.
I think they're all doing that well, aren't they? I bought here down at about 70 odd pence. I think it was 77.
Yeah.
And I actually sold out. You know, again, I doubled my money on those, and I just thought there's faster places to make money in the market. Yeah. But it still looks a good share. And what you see from others like Keller, you know, all these construction companies. I think there's a lot of construction. The construction index today was up 1%. So construction is doing pretty well in this country, and I think these companies are all going to do quite well. Yeah. So I'm not old at the moment, but they've got a lot of HS2 around the Buckinghamshire. Yeah. And I can tell you, they're working hard around here because they're just making a mess everywhere. You can't get, you know, your local town, you're going to be shut off for two weeks. It literally shutting a town off, more or less, because you're having to put bridges across and all that. And it still looks like it's going to last for ages. I look there, there's not even a sign of a train yet.
Yeah.
It's been going on for ages. And I look and I can't even see where the track's going to be. It's just service roads going in and bridges. Yeah. And I think, jeepers, creepers, it's going to... 80 billion wasted already. I bet it's going to get to 120 billion. People like Keir are going to have a nice little earner out of this still for quite a long time. And, you know, it's got to that big now where no government wants to say scrap it. Because, you know, okay, we've wasted 30 or 40 billion. Let's not waste another 40. They're in for a penny, in for a pound now. And they're just going to keep throwing as much money as they have to get this flipping thing completed. But it's never going to go any further than it's got. I can't believe anybody will even attempt to do another HS2. But Keir got a lot of HS2 business. And I'm trying to think what his name is. Andrew, the new CEO. It's not Andrew Carter. He's at Chapel Down. Andrew. I forgot his surname. But new CEO. Yeah, I watched the presentation. He does seem very, very capable. And, you know, I think they're going to pay 50% out of the 50% out of earnings out in divs as well, I think, if I remember rightly. So, you know, it's probably still a lot in them at this stage, and it wouldn't be one I'd sell, definitely not, but money out of it because I made so much money so quick and I thought I could find faster things to go up. So, I wouldn't tell anybody to sell it. You know, I'd say hang in there. Unless you've got something much better, hang in there. I think there's a lot of construction going to have to go on here. They're promising it later, so
it isn't just obviously, you know, housing and the Thames Crossing and HS2. It's also the energy transition with all the sort of the offshore connections and electricity. And so, yeah, there's masses of infrastructure. And I think what's quite interesting, if they do start re-engaging with the private sector to do the funding through the PPF? I can't remember what they were called. PPIs, I think they were called.
Private partnership.
Yeah,
private
initiatives. That's it, yeah. Yeah, so there's plenty of potential opportunity. We also had another question coming in from Ariel Cohen. He's basically asking about Luceco, which is the industrial lighting LED, not your domestic lighting, but this is your hardcore sort of like rugged lighting for chemical plants, industrial outlets, I think also for aerospace and defence and stuff like this. Mm-hmm. What's sort of your latest on this one? Because I think you talked about it last time.
I've liked Luceco, but just of late they promise and they're not delivering.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of their problem was the shipping costs in the Far East. All their stuff's made out in China. So I think a lot of people are a little bit sort of wary because if they're all out in China and there's any problems, they've got no alternative. So they are looking at other manufacturing places like Taiwan and stuff like that, I think. But I read it, XP Power's results the other day, and that didn't seem absolutely thrilling, nor did TTG, the other electronics companies. So I don't know whether the sector's a bit, you know, a bit bloated still. The one I've got is Dialight, which is the sort of like a domestic sort of version. And I've been buying a few of those lately. That's the only other one I've been buying recently. I did sell them off when I sold everything Friday before last, but I bought back again over the past few days because CEO I bought Blair, I think he bought 18,000. I've gone off on a tangent. I'm not answering about Luceco, am I? But they've got a legal battle that if they win could be worth twice the market cap of the business, Dialight.
Yeah.
So that's why I'm holding that. But Luceco, I like the products and
there's a bit of destocking, isn't it? I think in the whole industry, that's the sort of thing. You've got a headwind that will turn at some point.
Yeah, and you know, sort of, I'm 50-50 on Hornby, the CEO there. You know, he's a good CEO, he can make money, but he did once sell a load of shares just after the company floated. And the city hated him for it because he floated and he sold like 12 million shares. And then suddenly he put out a warning and the shares went down from, I don't know what it was, from about 3 or 4 quid down to pennies. And that's when I bought when it got bombed out. But I want to like the company. You know, I think I like the company. And when things improve, there's operational gearing there that will be worth having. But it just constantly lately sort of like promising and saying things are getting better. And then I come out with another statement. It just sounds a little bit not quite as good. So it's very, we'll call it hot and cold. I call it warm and tepid. It's like, you know, they go from slightly excited to slightly disappointed. And in the end, I think, oh, God, you know, I've just lost confidence in them, to be honest. I've lost confidence in a bit out of deliver. Maybe they'll come out and surprise me at some point and I'll buy back in them. But I think for now, all these electronic companies, Bolex is another one, you know, none of them have really got any sort of bargaining power because there's so much stock laying around still from, you wouldn't believe there could be that much stock, would you? You know, I sort of think you've been going on from COVID now for all this time, and now I'm watching shipping prices going back up. So, you know, so I sit there and think, you know, they've been complaining and saying, you know, tell us, oh, it's good now because shipping prices are going down, but they're not mentioning a lot about shipping prices going up yet, but although they did, I think, in their last statement. So a lot of variables there. I think there's better places that I can find to invest in than at the moment than electronic companies like Luceco.
Yeah.
So that's why I'm out at the moment. It's just tired of being disappointed by them and no good news in the sector, really.
Yeah. Wait for the spark to arrive back in those electrical stocks.
Yeah. Let someone else light the fire. You come and warm your hands later.
Okay. We've got one on from Daffodil asking about Beeks Financial Cloud. Now, I don't know whether it's basically a cloud capital markets business. They put their servers close to sort of like financial exchanges that allow sort of like the exchanges and hedge funds to basically trade ultra quick. And it's just won a contract previously. It's got a big contract with the South Africa and the Johannesburg Stock Exchange, but won another one. And sort of talk word on the street that it's out in the US somewhere. They've got regulatory clearance. This one company doesn't seem to put a foot wrong, but the shares have moved strongly upwards. Have you had a look at this one at all, Richard?
It just isn't my type of thing. So I'm not really. Yeah. I know Paul Scott is quite keen on these, I think.
Yeah, he is. Yeah, right. he talked about it this week. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, if he's quite keen on them, they're probably quite interesting. So, but I can't get excited by servers. You know, I just, wherever they are, a server's never excited me in my life. And I just can't get excited by them. You know, I've worked with servers and they don't do an awful lot. They just sit there and make an awful noise in the background.
Yeah.
And I find it difficult to, you know, and it's the competition. It's the competition I don't know about in these things. When you understand a business, you've not just got to understand the business you invested in, you've got to understand what the competition's like as well. Yeah. And that seems a very cloud servers and all this seems a very competitive area. And I sort of think, well, if they're doing it, why doesn't somebody else come in and just stick another thing next to where the servers are? And it doesn't sound something that's got high barriers to entry to me. That, you know, so it doesn't. I don't know enough a lot about technology to know this. You know, probably Paul would say, if I spoke to Paul, he'd say, "Oh no, you got it completely wrong because this, and this means that so and so can't do that." But it's never excited me enough to go and even have a look at it because I don't really understand it. I don't think I would even if I read about it. So keep it simple.
Yeah,
I like to keep it simple.
Yeah. I think for, you know, just for the audience, they've got actually quite some very good visibility because when you put the servers in place, etc., then they're really tough to get out people's systems because they a lot of the time require regulatory approvals, compliance, and a whole bunch of interns. So you get built into that hedge funds or certainly the stock exchange. So I don't think it's a matter of swapping it in and swapping out. And the clever bit is not just the server, it's the software and then the technology inside. So I think it's that end-to-end solution, to be fair, for the business.
Yeah, because a lot of these tech people don't want to move. I understand that, you know, sort of like, you know, once you've got something on it, you're almost nailed to it, aren't you? Because, you know, you've gone with them, and it might be so much better to go somewhere else, but the upheaval of getting all something from one place over to another place of, you know, another setup is often more pain than anybody's ready to put up with. So I can see how you could be sort of locked into these type of businesses. But like I say, I haven't got the wherewithal or the actual desire to go and look and see what the competition is like to feel safe enough to be invested in that one.
Yeah. Well, I know one you do a lot of sort of like due diligence and tasting is because Nigel Batty Smith is asking about M&S. Now, what's your sort of your latest on this one? Because I guess they're still not putting a foot wrong. They've done really well. You did very well out of the shares. But now that inflation is coming down, that's usually a bearish sign for retailers because they can't have as much pricing power. And also, obviously, you've got all the wage inflation still moving up at 5%, but your selling prices don't go up. What's your sort of your latest on Marks and Spencer? I guess you still quite like the curry sauces and the kebabs there.
Yeah, I've kept them going, actually. I think I've kept them up as best. I'm part of the reason why the share price is so high because, you know, they had, actually, when we were shopping over Christmas, £150 worth of shopping for free while I was in it. So that was a deal. I like to think Stuart Mason see how much I was talking about. I'm online and rigged it for me, but I'm sure he didn't. So, I think Marks and Spencer's a turnaround. But the beauty is they've still got a lot more stores to upgrade. Yeah. So, you know, they're doing a lot more upgrades, you know, great big out-of-town stores. And these have got far greater margins when you go out of town. And so that's boosting their margins a lot. But overall, you know, I sit down, I go into these stores and I think, can it get any better than this? But each time they surprise me. They just sort of do, you know, they've got the best ever steak pie. And I think, can you ever get better than your best ever steak pie? And it's your best ever steak pie, I suppose. But it's, the food's cracking in. I, you know, sort of, people would be surprised to know I like my food. And sort of like, you know, we go shopping in Marks each weekend and we do our shopping in there and stuff. And I could walk out with double the amount we walk in, you know, eyes bigger than your belly, and we just throw it all away because it just looks so lovely each week. And the marketing of it is great. And food's their biggest part. It's bigger than the clothing side. So that's the important part of the business. Yeah. But they're also improving the clothing side of things as well. They've got some great guys in there that have got great experience in the clothing. So, and Stuart Machin, I've got to say, is one of the most fantastic guys I've seen as a CEO. He's been retail all his life. And you've got how can I forget the chairman's name? Just come, Paul. What's his name? The chairman.
Oh, Archie Norman.
So, and he's Mr. Retail as well. So you've got the pair of them there that they're so sharp at retail and everything else. And all the boards you're seeing great as well. So one thing I'd probably say isn't so great is they've got this Sparks card. And I don't know what they're giving me on that. You know, we get a few little deals where I save £1 on fresh steak, or there might be a couple of other. They know it's not very good either. Someone came up with it and they're lumbered with it now. And so I think they're trying to work out a way of doing something better than this Sparks card giving you. Now, does a Marks and Spencer shopper really want 20% off their, you know, an Indian this week, you know, or whatever you're buying there? That doesn't appeal. People go to shop at Marks and Spencer's for the quality. So I think they've still got a long way to go. I think they're going to be one of the best retailers we've got in the country still. They're two, you know, them are next, class acts, you know. And to come through all this, I would have said Marks and Spencer's were dead and buried when your internet came on. Yeah. And I'd have thought that, you know, and when you look at Boohoo and ASOS and they can't survive because they're sending out loads of clothes. They have to take them back. And, you know, people just try them on at home and come back. And you've got these big stores like Next and Marks and Spencer's. You do click and collect. There's no cost to you when it comes back. Chances are these people walk in with stuff and they have a look around and they, you know, come in with a jumper to take back. They go out with two pairs of trousers and a fistload of dinner tonight. So the click and collect is quite a good way of getting customers into your store.
Yeah.
Which is great for a lot of these big retailers. But, you know, these completely online retailers, I don't see them surviving. I don't see ASOS and Boohoo surviving. You know, they're going to start charging people for returns. People just won't have it. Once you give stuff to people, they're reluctant to let you have it back, aren't they? You know, once people get acclimatized to a certain level of service from online retailers like Boohoo and ASOS, and then suddenly say, we're going to make a charge when you return stuff, they just don't, you know, if it's a prime charge, it won't work because people will just stop, you know, all this stuff. But even if it's an ordinary charge, you've been charging them nothing, now you're going to charge them $2.95 to return stuff. People are going to order less stuff, look at less stuff, and you're going to
see. Yeah, I mean, I think just on that one, there could be a sort of like a sea change happening in October, because one of the measures that's been talked about in the budget is to stop the likes of Shein and Temu importing product from China into the UK VAT-free, which is what they've been doing for years and has undermined their. So if they actually do decide to normalize the VAT figures for local retailers to overseas, then that will be a huge difference in terms of actually the economics for ASOS and Boohoo. But I think that could actually change it. Now, just, you made a really good point at the start in terms of, you don't fall in love with stocks. You may love the company, which you obviously do with Marks and Spencers. But I remember 20 years ago, who was the guy? There's a guy who owned Debenhams, and I can't remember what his name is, basically, who put a bid in for Marks and Spencer.
Philip Green.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, that's Richard Green. And he basically put a bid in for at about £3.25. 20 years on, today it's £23.25. So the stock has gone nowhere, even though you obviously love the product. So how do you make that distinction between sort of like, you know, you can't get enough of the product, you're absolutely, but the stock is something you want to sort of you trade and get profit. How do you see it?
So there's a lot of extra parts to Marks and Spencer's as well, isn't there? Because you've got Ocado, which they own 50% of the retail part of Ocado. And I just don't see how any part of that retail business is going to go anywhere other than Marks and Spencer's at some point. I think they're going to take the whole part of Ocado, the whole retail side of Ocado, and the Ocado just become the software company that provides the kit and the stuff for all the sorting and bits and pieces for their retail. Or they're going to just dump their holding and say, we don't want Ocado anymore. But the delivery side of it, I think there's a lot of other scope there. I don't know why Marks and Spencer's don't do delivery vans round to these industrial units. Yeah. Marks and Spencer's food, lunchtime, you went out to these industrial units. I'm sure they could sell a packet. You know, I see Joe's burger van pulls up down there and people wait there and have a grotty little burger that they risk their life on. Where, you know, Marks and Spencer's pulled out there. I think that's open. So those sort of things will be open to all sorts of shoppers, like women and, you know, other people. So there's a big opportunity there. It's one of the sort of things they could take. But I think there's loads of opportunities in their business. You know, overseas, they've not really done fantastic on, and they could expand overseas a bit more than they are doing. And opening these bigger stores, you know, providing services. They do, I think they've got opticians now, haven't they? I think they've got some of their, they do some, Marks and Spencer's have got, they sell, you know, optician services as well. You know, I've just been to Specsavers, and that was a complete disaster, my appointment there, the time they gave me. Where I just couldn't see Marks and Spencer's cocking up the way Specsavers did for me.
Yeah.
So people pay for that quality, and they can go into other, they can trickle into other little arms of retail that they haven't really been big on so far. So I think there's scope there for them. It's the same as that household. How much does Next do in household stuff compared to Marks and Spencer's? Next is, you know, all the home furnishings and stuff like that. Marks and Spencer's never really been that big on home furnishings. And so there's scope there as well. So, yeah, I know what you're saying. And it was Philip Green and Richard Rose in their big battle for Marks and Spencer's all that time ago. And you look back and you think, well, if this, but, you know, what was Philip Green, you know, he ended up going, you know, didn't do a lot, wouldn't have done a lot for the staff at Marks and Spencer's, I don't think, if he'd put up with it. I still think there's a lot of, you know, Marks and Spencer's, there's a lot more to come for in the retail sector. One of the few retailers that I would feel really quite safe being in at the moment.
Yeah, but I wouldn't suggest them going out to put vans on streets. The reason is because if the actual places you have to put vans, like ice cream vans and burger vans and stuff like that, it's all run by it is around Birmingham. It's all run by the organised crime scene.
Mafiosa. Yeah,
you don't want to be feathers without.
If you want to keep your kneecaps, no.
Yeah, exactly. So, I can't see them doing that.
But I do think, I'll probably will re-buy back my Marks and Spencers at some point. You know, I think they're not going to be a one bag. And I try to look for one bag is in a year. Like I say, you know, I won't say it's going to double in a year. And if you buy enough of those and you could just get a few right. But you can't always buy one bag is the things that look one bag. And you need a bit of diversity as well. And the way the market's got at the moment, I think Marks and Spencers would be a nice, safe pot to have your money in while, you know, if I was a bit nervous. So.
Okay, good. Well, we're coming to the end. I just got a reply from Daffodil talking about Beaks financially. Basically says the barriers to entry are actually really high. The data center space is now at a real premium, so his views are. So you might need to sort of compare notes with Paul Scott on that.
I'm not blind to everything. You know, if I can fix myself, I know enough about it, I might have a little
dabble.
I'm going to stick my beak in there and see what happens.
Yeah. Well, thanks very much. Thanks very much, Richard. Apparently, we're going to have a cracking weather tomorrow, so you can put your feet up and get that online order from Marks and Spencer, or alternatively go around the shop and get a big tub of ice cream. I don't know.
Yeah, no, I'm waiting for Saturday. It's the beer festival here Saturday. So.
Oh, is it? Oh, okay. Lovely.
Yeah. Sample some of that.
All right. Okay. Well, brilliant. Well, thanks again. Thanks everyone for your questions as well. And
nice to speak to you. Thank you for everyone for their questions. It's always, you know, it's nice to ask answer questions for people who've got sort of queries if I can. So.
No, you do absolutely brilliant. So, and Daffodil just says love listening. So, well done. Thanks for
that, Daffodil.
Yeah, good man. Cheers. Okay. Thanks very much then, Richard. I look forward in touching base in about 2 or 3 months' time.
Lovely. Yeah, I'll enjoy it. Thank you. Cheers, Paul.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.